Newark. This is Democracy Now!
The U.S. needs to go clearly above, I would say more than double, the commitments that were already made in relation to climate finance by the present administration.
Climate justice is on the agenda as world leaders gathered in the UK for the first time in person G7 summit in 2 years. We'll speak to Asad Rehman with War on Want, spokesperson for the COP26 Climate Coalition, calling for more immediate action. Then, the Biden administration continues to call for the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from Britain to the United States, where he faces up to 175 years in prison. We'll speak with Assange's father and half-brother, who are on a tour of the United States to advocate for his release.
Julian has been prosecuted for work that stops wars. Work that has won him journalism awards all over the planet. The Iraq and Afghanistan war logs, Guantanamo Bay detainee records. Work that exposes horrific war crimes and systematic abuse of power.
And we look at how another G7 country, Germany, recently apologized for its role in the first genocide of the 20th century in its former colony known as German Southwest Africa, now the country of Namibia. Descendants of those killed say Germany's offer of development aid is a pittance and are calling on the government to reject it.
Since this reparations amount was made public, concerns have been raised that this amount is not enough and that it is unacceptable to the affected communities and the Namibian people.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden and other leaders of the G7 nations are pledging to donate 1 billion doses of COVID vaccines to poorer countries as part of an effort to end the pandemic by the end of 2022. The World Health Organization estimates 11 billion doses are needed in order to vaccinate 70% of the world's population. The Group of Seven is holding its first in-person meeting in 2 years in Cornwall, England. On Thursday, President Biden formally announced the United States would do its part by buying 500 million doses from Pfizer to send abroad.
Our vaccine donations don't include pressure for favors or potential concessions. We're doing this to save lives, to end this pandemic. That's it. Period.
While Biden said there are no strings attached to the vaccine donations, none of the doses will be going to Venezuela, which is under U.S. sanctions. Venezuela's foreign minister, Jorge Arreaza, said the decision demonstrates Washington's, quote, continued hatred towards the Venezuelan people, unquote. On Thursday, the Venezuelan government revealed it has been unable to receive vaccines through the COVAX program because some of its financial payments have been blocked due to the U.S. sanctions. The New York Times is reporting the Trump administration secretly subpoenaed and seized the phone records of two prominent Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee, its chair, Adam Schiff, and Eric Swalwell, as well as their staff aides and family members, including a minor. Schiff described the move as a terrible abuse of power. The Justice Department forced Apple to hand over the records, then placed a gag order on the company, preventing it from informing the lawmakers until last month. The Trump administration also seized records from reporters at The Washington Post, The New York Times, and CNN as part of a sweeping probe into government leaks. On Capitol Hill, a bipartisan group of 10 senators said Thursday they have reached a deal on a $1.2 trillion infrastructure package, but many Democrats have criticized the proposal for not doing enough to address the climate crisis. Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey appeared on MSNBC Thursday night.
It sounds like to me that they have a package which is climate denial masquerading as bipartisanship. We can't have an infrastructure bill in 2021 that doesn't have climate at its center.
The United Nations and international aid groups warn Ethiopians in the war-ravaged Tigray region are facing the world's worst famine in a decade, with 350,000 people facing catastrophic conditions and millions more suffering from acute food shortages. The United Nations is urging the Ethiopian government to allow more humanitarian aid into Tigray, which the Ethiopian military invaded last year with support from Eritrea. In Peru, Pedro Castillo is closing in on becoming Peru's next president. With almost all votes counted, the socialist teacher has a 71,000-vote lead over Keiko Fujimori, the daughter of Peru's imprisoned former dictator. But Fujimori is seeking the annulment of 500,000 votes, despite offering no evidence of voter fraud. This comes as she's fighting to stay out of jail. A state prosecutor's urged a judge to send her back to prison in connection with an ongoing corruption case. On Thursday, Pedro Castillo, the presidential frontrunner, spoke to supporters in Lima.
Just as the people are with me, I must always be with the people. I will never take advantage of a democratic space to clean my debts, to clean my crimes. We cannot do that. We cannot play with democracy. Above all, there is the dignity of a people, and there are the generations to come. There is the dignity of these people who have long clamored for their rights.
In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces killed three Palestinians during a pre-dawn undercover raid Wednesday. The Israelis were dressed to look like Palestinians. The dead included two military intelligence officers with the Palestinian Authority. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas condemned what he called a dangerous Israeli escalation. Israeli forces also raided the headquarters of the Palestinian Union of Health Workers Committee on Wednesday and ordered the group's Ramallah office to remain closed for 6 months. Amnesty International warned Israel's action could have catastrophic consequences for Palestinians needing health care. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz has published shocking video of Israeli prison guards brutally kicking, punching, and beating shackled Palestinians inside a prison in the Negev Desert in 2019. The video shows guards throwing dozens of men into a large pile on a concrete floor. 15 were later hospitalized. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem said today, quote, "The case proves yet again that Palestinian victims of violence by Israeli security forces cannot achieve justice via Israeli systems and can hope to do so only in an international court," B'Tselem said. No Israeli guards faced charges over the assault. The warden on duty was later promoted. Amnesty International has accused China of committing crimes against humanity for its mass imprisonment and torture of Uyghurs and other Muslims in Xinjiang province. Amnesty International Secretary General Agnes Kayamard said, quote, "The Chinese authorities have created a dystopian hellscape on a staggering scale." China's long defended its policies in Xinjiang, saying they're needed to combat extremism. Lawmakers in Oregon have voted to expel Republican State Representative Mike Nierman after video surfaced showing him literally opening the door to let armed right-wing protesters enter the state capitol building in December at a time when the building was closed to the public. Days before the incident, Nierman spoke on a live stream where he gave out his phone number and explained how he could help them get inside.
If you say, "I'm at the west entrance during the session," and text to that number there, that somebody might exit that door while you're standing there.
The breach of the Oregon Capitol building occurred about 2 weeks before the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Meanwhile, six California men, including a former police chief, have been indicted on federal conspiracy charges for their role in the January 6th insurrection in Washington. Several of the men are connected to the far-right Three Percenters movement. In North Carolina, a state autopsy confirms Andrew Brown Jr., a black man who was shot by sheriff's deputies in April, died of a gunshot wound to the back of his head. The report lists Brown's cause of death as homicide and matched the results of an earlier independent autopsy and what Brown's family say they witnessed in body cam video. A North Carolina prosecutor concluded last month the shooting was justified and said officers will not be charged, prompting renewed protests demanding justice for Brown. The district attorney in Westchester, New York, has ordered an independent review of two separate fatal police shootings of black men over a decade ago, Danroy D.J. Henry and Kenneth Chamberlain Sr., a 68-year-old former Marine. Chamberlain was killed in his own apartment in White Plains, New York, in 2011 during a police confrontation after he accidentally triggered his LifeAid medical alert pendant. Within 2 hours, officers broke down his apartment door. They were doing a wellness check and shot him dead. Visit democracynow.org to see our full coverage of his story. In Behar County, Texas, a sheriff's deputy has been placed on administrative leave after video surfaced of him tasering a 16-year-old Honduran asylum seeker at the Southwest Key Casablanca shelter in San Antonio last year. Patrick Divers was placed on leave after a reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting published video of the tasering. Congressmember Joaquin Castro is calling for a federal investigation into what happened. Visit democracynow.org to see our interview with Aura Bogado of Reveal, who broke the story. And much of Puerto Rico lost power Thursday after a fire at an electrical substation. The massive blackout comes just days after the private U.S. and Canadian company Luma Energy formally took over management of the island's electric grid from the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, or PREPA, which was devastated by Hurricane Maria. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. World leaders are gathered in Cornwall in the UK for the first in-person G7 summit in 2 years. Talks are set to focus heavily on ending the pandemic and the climate crisis. President Biden announced the U.S. would donate an additional half billion COVID vaccine doses, quote, with no strings attached.
America will be the arsenal of vaccines in our fight against COVID-19. Just as America was the arsenal of democracy during World War II, this U.S. contribution is the foundation for additional coordinated efforts to help vaccinate the world.
While Biden announced there will be no strings attached, the vaccine doses will not go to Venezuela, which is under U.S. sanction. Leaders of the G7 nations are collectively pledging to donate a billion vaccine doses to poorer countries. Advocacy groups are continuing to apply pressure on governments to do more to end the global vaccine apartheid, including waiving intellectual property protections on vaccines. Protests are planned throughout the summit amidst a heavy police presence. Climate activists and groups including Greenpeace and Extinction Rebellion are staging actions to urge more forceful and immediate action from G7 nations. Ahead of the summit, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told NBC News the climate crisis is urgent.
When you are at the verge of the abyss, you must be very careful about your next step, because if the next step is in the wrong direction, you fall.
How much time is left to act?
I think this year is the make it or break it year. If we fail in Glasgow, we'll be in a very difficult situation. As I said, on the verge of the abyss, you must make sure that the next step is in the right direction.
G7 members are expected today to endorse a minimum global tax rate of 15%. For more, we're joined in London by Asad Rehman, executive director of War on Wants, spokesperson for the COP26 Climate Coalition. So it's all happening in Cornwall, the first in-person meeting of the G7. Asad, what are climate activists around the world demanding, and what are the plans for this weekend?
Well, as your intro shared, the G7, the richest and more powerful economies in the world, are meeting. But the people who are not around the table are, of course, those who are going to pay the price for their decision, the poorer majority of the world. And the G7 meets at a critical moment because it's not just one crisis, but we face multiple and compounding crises, so extreme that we're not just at the crossroads in human history, but of course heading towards a point of no return. And unfortunately, from the pronouncements that we've already seen and from what we understand will come out of the G7 in terms of the summit, they can see that our house is on fire. And yet, frankly, they're still discussing what colour to paint the door. So let's just take the climate crisis, for example. Despite all the promises to act on the climate emergency and recognising that whilst no threshold is safe, and as we can see from the devastating impacts on millions of lives as we breach 1 degree, that we have to prevent temperatures breaching the 1.5. What we've seen is carbon emissions in 2021 are the highest in a decade. Temperature levels are heading towards at least 2.5 degrees, if not more. The G7 is still pouring close to $189 billion to fossil fuel extraction. They're not making the pledges that are needed to make sure that they're doing their fair share. And they're still not even meeting the broken promise of a decade ago of realizing $100 billion in much-needed climate finance, when every estimate says at least the minimum that is now needed is at least close to $1 trillion a year for each and every year for the coming decade. This is no longer about climate denialism. What we've seen is mitigation denialism. It's the hope that somehow, and John Kerry famously said this at the G7 finance ministers meeting, that our quality of life is not up for negotiation, but we're going to rely on technologies that don't exist currently, and that somewhere in the future is going to suck out hundreds, and I say hundreds of billions of tons of carbon. I mean, that is just unprecedented. Public policy being made on the hope of fingers being crossed and that something will rescue us in the future and the poorest will pay the price.
I want to turn to another clip of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres in an interview that originally appeared on NBC News and is broadcast here as part of Covering Climate Now, a global consortium of news outlets strengthening coverage of the climate story. He was interviewed by reporter Ann Thompson.
Can the world combat the worst of climate change without helping poor countries?
It's impossible. You need to create the conditions for a transition from coal to renewable energy. And that, of course, requires financial investment, financial support and technological support to developing countries that still rely on coal for their own energy needs. More and more countries are committing not to finance coal plants even abroad. Korea has done it. I hope the G7 will be able to do it.
And so, Asad Rehman, talk more about this moment where climate, it's the first time ever it's on the agenda of G7. And also, if you can talk specifically about Britain's role on climate. The UK recently called for a climate Marshall Plan and your assessment of President Biden's plans.
Well, the UK government takes the world stage and claims that it's a climate leader and says, we've cut our emissions by 50%. But actually, if you take out because none of those emissions include aviation or shipping or all the embedded emissions of the products that the UK consumes, we're actually only talking about 15% emission reductions. That's about 0.5% of emission reduction. We're nowhere near the scale of emission reductions. Rich countries are still talking about net zero goals in 2050 when they should be talking about decarbonizing by 2030. And the COVID pandemic gives us a really good example of how these rich countries are, of course, responding both to the COVID pandemic, but also to the climate crisis. We've all heard the words, no one is safe until everyone is safe. We can all see that millions of people are dying around in every corner of the world. And yet, rich countries not just hoarded the vaccines, meaning that at the current rate, it will be 57 years before everyone in the world is vaccinated, but they're actively backing Big Pharma and protecting their profits. Now, if they won't lift the intellectual property rights on COVID vaccines, what hope is there for poorer countries that they're going to lift the intellectual property rights and provide the technology and the finance for them to be able to deal with the climate impacts, to be able to grow cleanly, to be able to transition away from the fossil fuel economy? And this is, of course, at the very same time as this incredible crisis of inequality, where 80% of the world faces poverty, half of it is still struggling on the equivalent of $5 a day, and not just facing that, but is rapidly getting worse. We've heard over the last year, 500 million jobs have been lost. Hundreds of millions of people are being pushed into extreme poverty. The very tools that rich countries use to protect their economies are being denied to those in poorer countries. And what we've seen is simply rich countries doing too little, too late, and not taking up their responsibility. And unfortunately, this G7 is not changed that at all.
And finally, your organization, War on Want, a global anti-poverty organization, does more than focus on climate. So if you can make the link and what you demand of the G7, not only around climate, but also in the midst of this pandemic. You have climate apartheid, what countries get hit the hardest, and also, of course, vaccine apartheid.
Absolutely. We see these forms of apartheid being played out. If you rightly said, we see a COVID apartheid, we see climate apartheid, we see economic apartheid, we see inequality and injustice all around the world. Really, what the G7 should be announcing is a global Green New Deal. They should be announcing and saying we're committed to making sure that everybody has the right to a living wage, to universal public services, health, education, housing. We all have seen how critical they are, not only to dealing with the pandemic, but are critical in terms of dealing with the climate crisis. We need to make food and energy a public good so that we can share them equitably. We have enough in the world, but of course, much of it is concentrated in the hands of a small elite. Just the top 1%, their emissions currently are double those of the bottom 3.5 billion people. If they were just reducing their emissions, we'd begin to see a major step forward. We need a radical transformation of our broken economy. We need to fix our unjust trade rules. We need to cap the power of corporations. And even the announcement about taxation of multinationals, it's, yes, a small step forward on the 15%. But we already can see that they're actively saying that that won't apply to finance, that won't apply to the big banks, that already there are going to be so many loopholes. What we really need is about 25% corporation tax around the world. We need to make sure that we're not just cancelling debt for the poorer countries, but actually we have a plan of reparations, of finance going from the global north to the global south. It's no good talking about charity, and all of these countries talk about, you know, that their response has been greatly charitable. For every $1 that is going from the north to the south, $24 flows the other way and enriches our big multinationals and countries in the global north. We can no longer tinker around the edges. We need a fundamental transition. And these coming years will determine literally the shape of the world. They will determine who dies, who lives, and what kind of economy that we're going to have. There is incredible demands coming up from the bottom. You see it in every corner of the world, basically saying our economy is no longer fit for purpose. It's failing people. It doesn't give people the quality of life that they need. It doesn't give them dignity. We need a transformation.
Asad Rehman, we want to thank you for being with us. Executive Director of Warren Want, Global Anti-Poverty Group, and the spokesperson for the COP26 Climate Coalition, speaking to us from London. Next up, the Biden administration continues to seek the extradition of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from Britain to the United States, where he faces up to 175 years in prison. We'll speak to Julian's father and half-brother. They're touring the United States to advocate for his release from a high-security prison in Britain. Stay with us. Great Men by Gang of Four. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. By the way, you can sign up for our daily News Digest email by texting the word Democracy Now!, one word, no space, to 66866 and get our headlines and news alerts. That's Democracy Now!, one word, to 66866. The U.S. State Department has pushed to extradite WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from Britain, where he has been locked up for over 2 years after being dragged out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he was taking refuge. President Joe Biden is now meeting with world leaders in the U.K. during the G7 summit. A U.K. judge blocked Assange's extradition in January, citing serious mental health concerns. Assange was indicted for violations of the U.S. espionage Espionage Act related to the publication of classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes. He faces up to 175 years in prison if brought to the U.S. On Thursday, the British Parliament held a debate on the safety of journalists, where Labour lawmaker Richard Bergen addressed Assange's case.
I appeal to President Joe Biden, now in the country for the G7, to drop the charges so that the extradition is called off.
This comes as Julian Assange's father and brother are on a nationwide tour of the United States to advocate for the founder of WikiLeaks' release. They're joining us now here in New York. John Shipton is Julian's father. Gabriel Shipton is a filmmaker and Julian's brother. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Thanks so much for joining us. Gabriel, let's begin with you. First of all, did it surprise you to hear Julian's case brought up in the British Parliament? And talk about where the case stands. The extradition was denied by a judge in January, yet he's still in the maximum security Belmarsh prison.
I wasn't surprised to hear it brought up in the parliament. There's quite a large support group for Julian in the UK parliament. I think it's got almost 30 members. So that group is, advocating for the charges to be dropped and the extradition to be stopped. Where Julian's case is at the moment, as you said, his extradition was rejected on the 4th of January. And his bail was refused on the 6th of January. So the U.S. has appealed the extradition rejection, and it's been 6 months now since since that extradition rejection, and we still don't know when there will be an appeal date. So Julian's just been sitting in Belmarsh prison for 6 months, not knowing when there will be an appeal heard. So really what I think we're seeing is an abuse of process to keep Julian imprisoned. He hasn't had any visits since October. He's the prison's in the COVID lockdown, so the situation there is really dire, and Julian is suffering inside that prison he's on remand. He has no sentence. So why is he in that prison? I just don't understand.
John Shipton, you're Julian Assange's father. When was the last time you got to see him?
Good morning, Amy. Some time ago, now March last year, I had a visit, and since then it's not been possible. There was one visit of Julian's children to the prison and Stella, his partner. They had to be separated during the visit by 2 meters or 2 yards in your money, and Julian had to wear full PPE. Now, Julian's in his cell 23 hours a day. The guard said to Julian, if your children embrace you or Stella embraces you, you will have to spend the next 2 weeks in lockdown 23 hours a day in your cell. You can see that there's comic ironies and difficulties all the time in the treatment of Julian. But that was the last visit. Gabrielle visited in October last year. So it's a very uncomfortable situation.
I wanted to go to Niels Melzer, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, who visited Julian Assange in London's Belmarsh prison several years ago.
I spoke with him for an hour just to get a good first impression. Then we had a physical examination for an hour by our forensic expert, and then we had a two-hour psychiatric examination. And all the three of us had the same impression, and well, I had certainly an impression that the medical doctors had a diagnosis. We all came to the conclusion that he showed all the symptoms that are typical for a person that has been exposed to psychological torture over an extended period of time.
So that's Niels Melzer, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, often shortened to the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. John, explain what your son is going through, the kind of isolation he's faced. He's been at Belmarsh for several years, but before that, also in a sense, to say the least, very isolated, though could see more people. We at Democracy Now!, I went to see him a number of times to interview him, and before when he was under house arrest. All this because the U.S. wants him in the United States to try him under the U.S. Treason Act. Can you talk about his mental state of mind now and why he does the work he does as a publisher of WikiLeaks and what he faces?
Well, Amy, the circumstances are, of course, described by Nils Mills very accurately. The mobbing, the smearing, the constantly not knowing where you stand. There's no end to it, so you can't count on one day being able to see your children. Over the number of years, has accumulated to a situation where Nils Mills accurately describes it as psychological torture. This circumstance it's easily fixed. The G7 meeting is based upon values, and yet they have just a few kilometers down the road a foremost journalist in jail. And so they can be genuine about basing the new world order on values and release Julian. That'll be something sincere. As to Julian, what motivates him, Julian rejects and has a sort of a natural leaning towards injustice. So wherever there's an injustice, also to right injustices requires speaking truthfully. The third thing is that freedom only comes about through knowledge. So once you accumulate knowledge and talk to your friends, and you are able then to make proper decisions and understand the circumstances that you're in or your community is in. So those three elements seem to be, to me, the prime motivating forces in the manifestation of Julian in the world.
Julian applied for bail. I mean, the judge ruled he was a suicide risk. She would not extradite him to the United States, Gabriel. And yet he has been denied bail. Can you talk about the significance of this? Why is he being held in London right now? And are you concerned that Joe Biden, now president of the United States, said when he was vice president, he likened Julian to a high-tech terrorist. That was the strongest criticism of the Obama administration. Have you had any dealings with the Biden administration at this point?
I think, you know, why Julian is still in prison, he's been punished like this as an example to everyone else, who, you know, might think about speaking truth to power, that this is what will happen to you. This is the extent that you will be pursued. So if you think about, publishing truth or truthful information, Julian is the example of what will happen. So it's just this chilling effect is already in place by what we're seeing, you know, what we've seen happen to Julian over the last 12 years of his detainment. We were here in January this year trying to see the Biden administration. We did have some contact through an intermediary with the human rights people in the administration we got a letter into them, and they said, you know, let's meet after the 20th of January. But obviously, a lot's happened since then, and you know, the Biden administration is, you know, has a lot to deal with at the moment. But really, I think this has to come from the DOJ. You know, Merrick Garland, this is a, you know, a Trump era prosecution, and you know, under an independent DOJ under Obama, found that this prosecution, they couldn't prosecute Julian because of what they call the New York Times problem, and so they didn't pursue the case. And
what's
at the end
New
of Obama's term, you know, Obama-Biden's term, Obama commuted Chelsea Manning's sentence. Chelsea Manning is the leaker that Julian is charged, that the Espionage Act charges are relating to Julian. So that was a, you know, a clear signal from the Biden-Obama presidency that, that, you know, that this prosecution wasn't going to go forward. And it was only under Trump, that, and it was the Trump DOJ, Jeff Sessions, and then William Barr who, you know, opened up this this prosecution. And so, you know, we're just asking Biden and Merrick Garland to just revert to the independent DOJ under Obama's position that this prosecution was, you know, detrimental to a free press and First Amendment and the Constitution, which is, you know, I think we find it quite ironic that two Australians are travelling the country, travelling the US, you know, talking about a free press and the First Amendment.
John, if you can talk about what Julian released, the kind of information that ultimately millions of documents on the Afghan war, on the Iraq war, the State Department cables. And if you could start by talking about a video we have shown a number of times because WikiLeaks made this available. It was a video that Reuters had requested for years. It's about what happened to their two employees, Namir Nur Eldin, their 22-year-old up-and-coming videographer, and their, his driver, Saeed Shema, father of four, 40 years old, who were in this area of Baghdad called New Baghdad, and they were being taken around by the community to show what had happened in their community the day before a bombing. And U.S. Apache helicopter comes overhead and opens fire on this group of men below, killing both Reuters staffers as well as the community members. Can you talk about the significance of this video coming out that Chelsea Manning had made available to WikiLeaks and other examples?
Well, yes. That video is sort of like fundamental to a change in understanding of the United States and its allies in Iraq and the destruction of that country. So that is a pivotal point. So we understand from that that the occupation of Iraq was a tragedy and that the ongoingness of that tragedy is in the Iraq War files. So the Iraq War files revealed that 15,000 civilian deaths had happened and that were unreported in the current literature, but they were in the Iraq War files. One of the really important revelations in the diplomatic cables was that there was an attack by a group of soldiers on a house outside Baghdad wherein the entire family was destroyed and killed. Contemplating this crime, the soldiers called in an airstrike and obliterated all evidence of those murders and destroyed the house. When this cable was seen after the release by WikiLeaks, when it was seen by the Iraqi parliament gathered together the courage to refuse the status of forces agreement that the United States and its allies had put before them. As a consequence of that refusal, the United States and its allies withdrew their troops from Iraq. So in this circumstances, we can see a profound thing about the leaks and the publication of those leaks that had brought about peace and it ended a war. There are several more examples of that. So there's an American lawyer, Clive Stafford Smith, set up an organization named Reprieve. And using the Guantanamo Bay files, Clive was able to go to Guantanamo Bay and secure the release of prisoners who were there under circumstances that they were innocent of any crime and had been sold to the United States Army and moved to Guantanamo Bay. 22 of those prisoners were children at the time. So that's another circumstance. A third one, if I could illustrate, it concerns the United Kingdom's removal of the entire population of the Chagos Islands in order to provide the United States with an air base called Diego Garcia. Using the revelations in the cables, the people of the Chagos Islands and their lawyers were able to take a case to the International Court of Justice and win. Despite the United Kingdom's appeal, they continued to prevail. So there's three examples of what a leak can bring about, and that the importance of these revelations, and finally, that those documents are in a searchable library so that ongoing they can be used to further people's desire for justice and to deepen the understanding of the people of the United States of the involvement of their Pentagon and their foreign policy, their involvement and the exercise of that foreign policy and the disaster that it's brought to parts of the world.
John Shipton and Gabriel Shipton, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us. You are on this tour across the United States, brought here by the Courage Foundation, arrived in Miami, doing events here in New York, in Philadelphia, D.C., Boston, Columbus, Chicago, Milwaukee, as you travel the country. Next up, Philly today. Thanks so much for spending this time with us. John Shipton is the father of Julian Assange, Gabriel Shipton, a filmmaker, and Julian's brother. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. When we come back, we talk about Germany apologizing for its role in the first genocide of the 20th century in its former colony, now known as Namibia. But descendants are saying that Germany's offer of development aid is a pittance and are calling on the Namibian government to reject it. Stay with us. Give Me Back Namibia by Jackson Kaowa. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to look at developments with another G7 country, Germany, which recently apologized for its role in the first genocide of the 20th century, which took place in its former colony known as German Southwest Africa, now the country of Namibia. Between 1904 and 1908, German colonizers killed tens of thousands of Ovaherero and Nama people in Namibia. Last month, for the first time, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas officially described the massacre as genocide and outlined an offer of more than $1.34 billion in development aid to Namibia.
Today we officially refer to these events as what they were, a genocide. We are therefore acknowledging our historical responsibility. And in the light of Germany's historical and moral responsibility, We will ask Namibia and the descendants of the victims for forgiveness. And as a gesture of recognition of the immeasurable suffering that was inflicted on the victims, we want to support Namibia and the descendants of the victims with a substantial program worth 1.1 billion euros aimed at reconstruction and development.
The Namibian parliament is set to vote soon on Germany's offer, which was not negotiated with survivors of the genocide, and critics have described as a pittance. This week, Namibia's prime minister, Sara Kugongwele Amadila, opened a contentious session of parliament addressing the agreement. She spoke Tuesday.
Since this reparations amount was made public, concerns have been raised that this amount is not enough and that it is unacceptable to the affected communities and the Namibian people.
Opposition lawmakers spent the parliamentary session denouncing the deal. This is Utara Mutu of the opposition Landless Peoples Movement Namibia.
Honorable Prime Minister, never in my existence as a millennial would I say that I'll be looking at a colonizer the way I'm looking at you right now. You have betrayed us.
In a minute, we'll get response from two Namibians. But first, this is part of a BBC documentary about the genocide by historian David Adeteo Alusogo. It's titled Namibia, Genocide and the Second Reich.
For 100 years, what happened in Germany's long-lost African empire has been hidden. It's the story of a genocide that implicates the highest level of the German government, the army, and even some of Germany's biggest companies. But the ghosts of the Namibian genocide have been reawoken. They've returned to haunt modern liberal post-war Germany. And in doing so, they've forced Germany to wake up to a very uncomfortable fact, that the dark racial theories that helped inspire the Nazis run much deeper into German and European history than most people want to acknowledge.
Soldiers received specific orders which allowed them to kill anyone. It was an overall strategy aimed at ethnically cleansing the countryside to create Lebensraum for German settlers.
The whole process was genocidal. The deliberate extermination of Herero, the Vernichtungsbefehl, the destruction order. Many of members of my own family died.
That's an excerpt from the BBC documentary Namibia, Genocide and the Second Reich. For more, we're joined by two guests. MC Erastus is with us. She's in Windhoek, the capital of Namibia, which was the site of Germany's first mass concentration camp, where thousands of people were beaten, worked, and starved to death by the army of the Second Reich of Germany. Also with us is Nyoko Muvangal. She is the born of Ova Herero people and grew up in a village in Namibia. Now a lawyer in South Africa, she's joining us from Johannesburg. I want to begin with Nyoko Murangwa. Can you respond to what Germany is offering and who they negotiated this deal with?
Good morning, afternoon, depending on where you're listening from. What Germany is offering is, there are two answers to that. The first is over €1 billion. And it is not reparations, it is grants. And the amount was negotiated with the Namibian government to the exclusion of both the Ova Herero and the Nama people. We were just excluded from all of this. So that's the immediate answer to your question.
And what is your response to what they are offering? And what are you demanding? You're a descendant of those who died in this genocide at the turn of the 20th century, the first genocide of the 20th century. And if you can tell us further, because I think, I dare say, certainly people in the United States, most people, have never heard of what took place.
Sure. If I may, I wonder whether I should commence perhaps your question elsewhere. What I would like to start with is what happened between 1904 and 1908, which would better inform my response to your question. Between 1904 and 1908, Germany, as a colonizer of Namibia, wanted land, Namibian land. And the Ovaherero and Nama people at the time were land and cattle owners. So Germany wanted them to give up the land when they resisted. The German government, through a general, an army general called von Trotta, issued an extermination order which was specific. It said all the Ovaherero and all the Nama peoples must be killed. There were two extermination orders, one pertaining to the Ovaherero and the other pertaining to the Nama people. But what those extermination orders said was both must be killed, spare no woman, spare no child, and spare no man. Either drive them out of the country, they could go to Botswana, Angola, or Southern Africa, but they must either die or get out of Namibia. And that's exactly what happened. Our land got taken, our cattle got taken, our people got killed. Those that survived were forced out of the country into Botswana, Angola, Southern Africa, and elsewhere as well. And those that were not able to leave the country were enslaved. They were in concentration camps. They were poisoned. So that's the background of this. And I'm not sure about the number of the Nama people who got killed, but history tells me that 80% of the Ovaherero people got killed during the genocide. Fast forward to 2004, the then German ambassador, I believe, in Namibia, said this was in response to people, to the Ovaherero and Nama people themselves, taking hold of their agency and saying what happened to us at the turn of the 20th century was a genocide. We are entitled to reparations, but at the very least, from a human being point of view, we are entitled to an apology from Germany. The then German official stood up at a gathering in Namibia, in rural Namibia, and purported to apologize. However, that got recanted by the government, the German government, by saying that she had no mandate to do that. The German government was not apologizing. Reverse and fast forward a little bit. Concurrently, there were proceedings instituted by the Ovaherero and the Nama people in New York, seeking the German government to do two things. The one is to apologize and for the genocide, and the other to pay reparations. In court papers, the German government took the attitude that whatever was committed in Namibia between 1904 and 1908 there was no crime called a genocide. So whatever was committed at the time could not have been a crime because the crime of genocide did not exist at the time. So that this has always been Germany's stance. So it is to me very interesting, the turn suddenly to call what happened in 1904 a genocide. And I don't understand German myself, but when one listens carefully to the translations of what Mr. Ma said, he seems to be saying that what happened then should be called what it would be today, a genocide. There's a nuance there, but for present purposes, it is sufficient to accept and take that Germany is called what it did in Namibia at the time, is calling what it did in Namibia at the time to the Ovaherero and the Nama people a genocide. So what then happens when you accept wrongdoing? When you accept wrongdoing, you do two things. You apologize and you repay. You atone, and that's in the form of reparations. In Namibia, what happened in 2006 is in Parliament, the then paramount chief of the Ovaherero people tabled a motion which was unanimously adopted in Parliament, that the Ovaherero and Nama people would directly negotiate with Germany for reparations, and that the Namibian government would serve the role of a mediator, it was more of a supporting role. But then what the Namibian government turned away from that resolution altogether, excluded the Ovaherero and the Nama people, negotiated directly with Germany, and that's the result of what you were asking me about earlier, the grant or aid money, and the very loose statement by Mr. Maas in newspapers of the world. Germany has still not approached the people directly, by the way. This is something that no one is talking about. We are hearing from newspapers, from yourselves, that Germany is calling this a genocide. Germany is apologizing. Germany has not come to the Ovaherero people or the Nama people to apologize at all for what happened. In fact, the minister was supposed to come, and the president, the minister was supposed to come to Namibia a week or so ago and cancel the trip because of the uprising of the, not physically, but the rejection of the offer by the Ovaherero and the Nama people. So you want to know what my comment is on that. My comment is that what was offered is an absolute insult. It's an insult because it had nothing to do with us. Our names are being used in circumstances where what is really going on between the German and the Namibian government has nothing to do with us. And one wonders whether the Namibian government and the German government are negotiating as equals. I shudder to think not. They are not negotiating as equals. And it was also interesting that when the announcement was made, the Namibian government was caught off guard. It didn't realize that Germany was going to announce to the world that it had offered this grant money and purported to apologize to the Ovaherero, or to the Namibians, I suppose, to use Germany's language.
Yoko, I wanted to bring MC Erastus into this conversation, who's in the capital of Namibia right now, who's in Windhoek, a researcher on decolonization and technology. MC, you wrote a piece for the BBC headlined, "Why Germany's Namibia Genocide Apology is Not Enough." In it, you say Germany needs to come to terms with the origins of a racialized view of the world, placing Western authorities at the top and Africans at the bottom. Can you give your reaction to what has been offered and what you see needs to be done at this point? We have just about a minute.
So I wanted to start off with what Advocate was saying and a clip that you played and sort of tied in with what the German foreign minister must said or in his apology. What Advocate Nyoko said is that she questioned the relationship between Namibia and Germany and questions if it's that of equals. And what we are seeing in reparations, especially with the Ovaherero and Nama genocide, is that, first of all, when Germany came to Namibia or Southwest Africa, whatever they deemed to call it at that time, they did not come to have a friendship or a relationship. The mission was clear at the Berlin Conference. It was to the scramble for Africa, and some scholars call it the rape of Africa. It was to come and take the resources of Africa. So from the very beginning, Germany needs to acknowledge the relationship that did exist during the genocide, when the genocide took place. It was not a friendly it was not a friendly relationship. It was not one of equals. When we look at what history tells us, is that people who were in the land at that time, they were deemed to be savages, barbaric, tribes. Still to this day, the narrative is still going on in the media where we call the Ovaherero and Nama communities as tribes, and we call the Germans as settlers or former colonial powers or something like that. You know? So already...
We have 5 seconds.
When you're just speaking... Yeah, when we are just speaking, there is no equality in that. And that already, we should start to question that before we even go to discuss anything when it comes to
genocide. We will come
apology.
Back to this issue. I want to thank you, MC Erastus and Yoko Muvangwa. Thank you. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.